Welcome to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. This show will first be broadcast on Wednesday, July 10th, 2024. Happy birthday, Sister Nancy the Dwee, on 91.7 FM WHUS Stores. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician, with my co-host Ron Meniza. We're coming to you live from beautiful Mansfield Hollow, Connecticut. Comment below to let us know you're here and ask questions. You can also email me at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, Patreon, and Buzzsprouts. You may also watch the recorded Facebook Live and Instagram Live episode at Fran Storch ND. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. The information presented on this show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. Here's the update on us. I've got a knee that comes and goes. Right now, I'm recovering from it coming, and it was sore. I had a good month of a lot of riding and a lot of exercising, and then all of a sudden, last Tuesday, after doing just normal, you know, weight training and yoga in the morning before work, the meniscus decided to slip, and I had a lot of pain in that medial side again. And so I had to get off the knee and not do very much, and went to the chiropractor. And from everything I read, as I've said before, if you can avoid surgery on a meniscus, it's a good idea. And the reason is because when they go in and do surgery, they take out pieces of your meniscus, and your meniscus is capable of healing if you take care of it the right way. If you take pieces out, then you have less cushion, and then eventually, as you start taking pieces out, you have less and less cushioning there, and then you eventually get to that place of bone on bone, in which case your orthopedic surgeons can say, all right, time for a knee replacement. And I would certainly like to avoid that. And I find that the pain definitely comes and goes. One source that I read is figure out how long you're in pain for, and then once the pain stops, stay light on it, rest it for that amount of time. So it hurt for only four days. And so it stopped hurting. The first day there was no pain was the day after I had gone to see good old Dr. Scott. He did a good job of adjusting me, I'm assuming. And so it was two things. I saw Dr. Scott. And the other thing that happened was I added in a supplement that I hadn't been taking for a long time, which has, it's what we call a protomorphogen. It has compounds in it that directly are nutrients for tendons and ligaments. And so I'm taking that in addition to taking the collagen that has anti-inflammatories in it. So I have collagen plus this ligament supplement, and my knee's been better. I'm doing regular icing at least once a day, and probably if I were hanging around more, I do the icing more than that. Although there's not a lot of pain, so I'm guessing there's not a lot of inflammation. It just needs to be calm and let it rest. I have a variety of braces. I have braces of varying tensions. I have a brace that I can put ice gel into that I just got yesterday. And I also had been given physical therapy exercises, which put some stress laterally on the knee, and I'm deciding that I'm going to stay off of those for a few weeks until that knee. I'm confident that the knee is in a little bit better shape. Those and the clamshells, with the bands, I'm going to stay off those for a little while. What I might be able to do is do those same exercises but without the band, so there's a little less resistance. I went into a pool yesterday and I did those exercises with no bands in the water, and I think it was a little too stressful on the knee. So I may just hold off on those for a little while. If I do yoga, I just use, if there's any twisting or turning, I either don't do the twisting or turning, or I do a lot of bolstering so it minimizes the twisting and turning, and do things that are mostly in a front to back plane. And I've been off the bike since last Sunday, I think. And so I'll stay off the bike. My plan is if there's no pain on Wednesday, I'll go back, I'll go back and I'll have had a week and a half off the knee with no cycling. I am doing yoga and I'm doing exercises. And I'm not walking either. And walking is something I could start as well, as long as it's gentle and flat and on an even plane. And I might start that as well. So that's what's going there. I have tape. The other thing that I found is you can get tape that has infrared properties in it. So that's going to, yeah, I know, right? I found it online and it's reasonably priced. It's, you know, the same as all the other tapes you can get. So I found that. So I ordered some. I'm going to try that. I have some very good tape on right now. It's just your classic, very sticky tape that stays on for a few days. But I found this tape that has the infrared in it, and I haven't seen that in any stores. That I had to order it online. So I'm going to try that. So if infrared is going to import, it has some kind of compound in it that makes it so that you get some infrared energy into your knee, which is going to promote healing a little bit faster. That's kind of exciting. I also have pain patches that have herbs in them. I haven't tried those yet. So there's just so many things that you can do. My goodness. And then I'm doing stabilizing exercises that are in one plane. So I'm doing the isometric leg lifts, and I'm also doing one-legged deadlifts. So as I do those, I'm hoping they will strengthen the sides of my knees. And then lunges, as long as they're not too intense, I'm doing those as well with support on the knee, and I'm hoping that's going to get some strength in there as well. And if I'm in pain, I do a lot less of that. Right now, I'm not in pain, which is exciting. But you have to remember, with a meniscus, just because you're not in pain doesn't mean that you don't still have a tear. So that's something to be concerned about. So it's lovely. As far as the autonomic nervous system, I had a blip a couple of weeks ago. And when I had that happen, I don't know if it was like a day-long sort of migraine phenomenon. So I had to get off the bike again and rest. And I added in killer lime herbs. So I go back and forth with the herbs that kill. So that would be your cryptolepis, your cat's claw, your sweet Annie. And then I backed off on those after I started to feel better. So I haven't had the shakes in a long time. So that's really good. So I'm continuing to use the cordyceps and rhodiola and and herbs to help me with my heart and my blood pressure. So I have motherwort on board. And I'm also taking milk thistle to help my liver function better. And I'm still taking modified citrus pectin, which helps to reduce inflammation. So all those things are still going on. So there you go. And let's check in with Ron. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing okay. I'm, you know, riding my bike.
Yeah.
Not very well, but I'm riding my bike. But I'm riding, you know, just very, very slow on the hills because I have no leg strength.
Oh.
But, you know, I have no muscle strength in general just because I have not been, you know, able to push very hard.
And, right.
But I think, and I'm not 100% sure on this, but I think that the damage that was done by the pharmaceutical has left me.
Really?
I think so. I'm kind of guessing that as of my ride. I rode up to the community center this morning to teach my class. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think I'm just like really, really weak. Like I'm starting all over again.
Yeah.
Right now. So I don't seem to have the same issues that I had when I was, you know, recovering from the pharmaceutical.
Right.
But my legs are atrophied and I've got no power.
Right.
No power whatsoever.
Yeah.
I heard an interesting thing in spin class this morning. Of course, mm-hmm. one of my retired professors, who is also a former marathon runner and rides the spin bike now for his physical fitness, Bill said that when he was down at the University of Texas, one of his colleagues, they were both running a lot, and one of his colleagues was running a test, and they were testing people's people by basically strapping down people that were normally physically fit.
Yes.
And having them just stay in bed and not move at all.
Ugh.
And then doing tests on them to find out how quickly their legs started atrophying.
Yeah.
9 hours.
Ugh.
9 hours is the beginning of it.
Wow. And when you do nothing at all.
That's when you do nothing at all.
Right.
So by being completely immobile, your muscles start to atrophy after 9 hours of not doing anything.
No kidding.
And, you know, we're talking walking around, going up and down stairs, anything, you know, is not going to affect it as much. But if you just sit completely still, that's what happens.
Wow.
So,
Why they try to get you out of bed when you're in the hospital.
Right. So 3 months, you know, or 3.5 months is another story in itself.
But that's you who haven't been sitting doing nothing.
I have not, no. but I'm very weak. Yeah. I just don't have a lot of muscle structure. So I'm going to put myself on a training schedule and I'm going to cry a lot and, you know, I'll get back, but I want it back. And I've been reading a bunch of things, including Chris Carmichael.
Chris Carmichael.
Yeah, good old Chris Carmichael. Yes. And cycling after 50. And
right.
Between the ages of 50 and 70, and I will have that on my show today. I'm going to talk a little bit more about that today on my show because I need to get myself excited about putting my
So only between 50 and 70? Because you're going to be 70 next year.
Yeah, so what's your problem?
So what do you do after you're 70?
You just keep doing what you do.
No.
You just keep doing what you do.
Because you need to know for 70 to 90.
Well, it's coming. I mean, Chris just turned, he's your age. He's 60.
Oh.
So, you know, he's now feeling the effects of age. And, you know, and I have a piece that he wrote of like 4 myths that people talk about when you get older.
Yeah.
When athletes get older.
Yeah.
And they're all really interesting. So I think you'll be amused by that when we get to my show today.
It's true.
So anyway, I'll be back. I'll
be back.
I'll be back. Yeah. It's going to be a long, hard road. That's all.
Yeah.
You know, I know how to do this. I just have to do it.
Yeah. And you have to be consistent.
And consistency is key.
And you have to fit it in with all the other 97 things you're doing.
Yeah, but, you know, it's riding your bike, so it's like that's kind of a thing I do, so that's not really a problem. I can't get the same kind of strength on a spin bike that I can get by doing,
of course not,
you know, other things
on
like
the road.
Squats or road or
yes.
whatever. But one-legged drills are in there. There's a bunch of stuff I'll talk about later. We'll be back.
So listen to Bicycle Talk.
Yeah.
Here on 91.7 FM WHUS Doors and on Facebook and Instagram and wherever you're listening to us.
Mm-hmm.
Listen to Bicycle Talk as well. So that's how Ron is doing. We're working through it. We really are. I think the biggest thing for me that's the hardest thing to do is rest.
Yeah, especially when it's summer, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, you just...
And all your friends are out doing, like, epic rides.
Everybody's doing stuff.
You feel like you're missing out. So anyway, let's talk about some other things. So where we left off last time, we were looking about to look at herbs for acute injuries. So here's some herbs that I like to use. So let's talk about arnica for a moment. So people use arnica, and they use arnica separately, and they use arnica in combination. You can take arnica as a homeopathic remedy. Remember, a homeopathic remedy... is a remedy that if you use it in material doses, it may cause symptoms. And when you dilute it and potentize it way down, it can help to alleviate the symptoms that it would cause in material doses. And so you can take very low potency. So the higher the potency homeopathic, the more effect that it will have, the less often you have to take it, and the deeper it will go into your system. So arnica is a homeopathic remedy you can use for acute injuries, especially when the person feels like they say to you, no, I'm fine, and you know they're not fine. Arnica is a good first remedy for a head injury, and or you can also give arnica for a head injury even if it's been a long time ago. If a person comes into me, I've never felt well since my concussion. So when was your concussion? 5 years ago. Okay, we can give you arnica now. So you might give them a single dose of a high potency 1 mg or 10 mg or something like that, and that can get into their system and help to correct what was going on. Help ask the immune system, or just ask your energetic system to heal what went wrong from what happened with the arnica. You use arnica when you have a feeling of being bruised, You can use it for actual bruising. And if you have actual visible bruising, what I recommend is to get arnica salve with actual arnica in it, not necessarily homeopathic. The only thing about arnica is that in material doses, it's supposed to be toxic. You're just not supposed to ingest it. It's safe to put on your skin, but you're just not supposed to eat it. So you can get arnica oil that's just got oil in it and with arnica in it, and then you can apply it to bruises. You can also apply it to areas that you don't see bruising, but it feels like you're bruised. If you have a bruised sensation, that's an appropriate use of arnica. And you can use the actual oil. You can get salves with arnica, actual arnica in it. You can also get homeopathic topicals that you can use arnica. And again, the same indication. So one of the funny things about some herbs is that you use the herbs. So some herbs you use where they're toxic in material doses, but when they're in homeopathic doses, they are they correct the symptoms that the material doses would cause. Some herbs you use the same indications for the herbal use for the material doses as well as the homeopathic doses, and arnica is kind of like that as well. In fact, most of the herbs that I'm going to talk about now are like that, whether you use them homeopathically or whether you use them in material doses. They have the same indications. So arnica you can use as an oil or a salve topically. You don't take it internally. Homeopathic arnica you can take internally, but it has to only be homeopathic remedies. And not the creams. Don't eat something that was meant to be topical. You get the homeopathic pellets, and those you can take internally. But for when you come out of it's definitely for head injuries, and it's definitely for acute injuries, and it's definitely when the person is like, no, I'm fine, and they're not. And also, if there is bruising, visible bruising, or if there is a sensation of bruising, even if it's not visible, it tends to move circulation, and then that's like stagnant blood, and that's one of the indications for it. Then there's hypericum, also known as St. John's wort. I saw St. John's wort blooming, and the way you tell St. John's wort, it's called hypericum perforatum. And if you take the leaf, the little tiny cute leaves, and you hold them up to the sun, you will see little dots going through the leaf, and that's a way to identify St. John's wort. The other thing you can do is to take a bud off the St. John's wort, and the bud turns into these pretty little yellow flowers because it's an asteraceae. It's in the same family as dandelions and asters and Jerusalem artichokes and sunflowers. It's the same family, Asteraceae. Aster is a Greek word for a star, and so all these flowers look like stars. They're very pretty. And so it has these little star-shaped, pretty five-petaled flowers. And if you take a bud or a flower and you pull it off and you crush it between your fingers, it will not be yellow between your fingers. You'll have this beautiful, deep, ruby red burgundy oil that comes off in your fingers, and that's the hypericin. And so that's another way to identify it. It's a very powerful herb. It has a lot of antioxidants in it, and we think of hypericum, St. John's wort, as being good for nerve injuries, so any kind of nerve pain. So if you have nerve pain, you can apply hypericum oil, which again is this beautiful burgundy color, and you can apply it anywhere. It happens to be good for skin healing as well, and we often recommend St. John's wort oil when a woman is pregnant to help to soften her belly and to help to deal with stretch marks. But you put it on and use it for, you can put the oil on when you have nerve pain anywhere there is. And again, you can use topicals that are homeopathic or herbal for the same indications for nerve pain and pain in general. And you can take the homeopathic orally, and it can help as well. We'll often use alternating arnica and hypericum post-surgically, and it can help people to heal from surgery a little bit faster. And so we have a procedure by which we do that. So hypericum is a really good, it's a really nice homeopathic or herbal remedy for nerve pain. You can also take St. John's wort hypericum pills, and that can help with mood. Hypericum or St. John's wort is also good. It's a great antiviral. So you can take St. John's wort for various viruses. It's very good against herpes viruses. So a herpes virus would be herpes simplex. So if you have genital or oral herpes, if you get cold sores or if you get sores on your genital area, it's a great antiviral, and it also can help with the pain. And if you have a cold sore, you can use salves that have St. John's wort in them or the homeopathic, and you can put them topically, and it can help to resolve the, and that's a case where I'd probably recommend using the actual oil, because you're going to get a local antiviral benefit as well as a pain benefit. So helpful for herpes viruses. So that's going to be either herpes simplex, and you can try it also if you unfortunately have shingles. And shingles is a reemergence of varicella zoster, which is also a herpes virus, which is the virus that causes chickenpox. So you may already know this, but I'm going to just repeat it, that if you get chickenpox any time in your life, you can get shingles, because herpes viruses, once you have them, they stay dormant in your body. And then when your immune system is offline, they can reemerge. And shingles is a bad scene, because the viruses live in your nerve roots. And then if your immune system goes down offline enough, they travel to the end of the nerve roots, and they cause the they cause blistering, and they cause that classic pain, and the nerve becomes inflamed, which is why you have all this nerve pain. And classically, shingles covers a dermatome, so it's at a certain nerve root, and it only tends to emerge in one dermatome unless you're very immunosuppressed. And so St. John's wort can be helpful for that. All right, and then there's comfrey. Comfrey is one of my favorite plants. There's been years ago, there were some issues with comfrey where somebody had liver damage and they took too much of it and it hurt their liver more. And so people are afraid to use comfrey, and I think that's not necessary. That was an isolated incident, and comfrey is generally a very safe herb. You can take it orally, and you can use poultices, and you can use salves, and you can use oil. Comfrey is also, the genus is Symphytum. Symphytum means it knits bones, and that is one of the herbs that you can use to help mend bones. So if somebody has a fracture, I will have people either take comfrey tincture or use comfrey oil, or use a salve that has other bone knitting herbs in it. I have a salve that I have my herbalist make, and she puts in comfrey and boneset and teasel, and she puts Remania in it too, which are all bone knitting herbs. And so you can do it topically. I like to offer comfrey and boneset to people who have fractures or bruising in places that it's hard to splint. So collarbones, where you're just given a sling. And I also like it for ribs. You know, if you happen to crack or bruise your ribs, it generally doesn't get splinted. I mean, you might get a wrap, or you might not get anything. You can also tape ribs, and you can tape collarbones too. Often you're not offered very much. And when you use the salve can hasten the healing. So you can use comfrey salve, and you can use combination salves that are meant for bone knitting on those areas. And I had that salve made because I'm a cyclist, and people tend to break things that are hard to access, like collarbones and ribs. So comfrey has allantoin in it, so it is also great as an antiviral and can be applied to viral lesions like cold sores and to genital herpes, and again can help with pain. It has those antiviral properties. It's also very soothing and mucilaginous, so it can be applied to injuries. It can be applied to open wounds, and it can also be used. You can take the tincture or tea if you have a stomach ache, and it'll help to heal your stomach, which is great. Calendula is that way as well. So calendula is another herb in that Asteraceae family, and same family as asters and dandelion and sunflowers. And calendula is very pretty, you know, pot marigold, and also has wonderful healing properties. Can be used homeopathically, it can be used topically as well, and can also be taken internally. And comfrey and calendula are also, they're great herbs for stomach aches. So if you have If you have inflammation in your stomach, it can help to heal that. And they're very impressive. So calendula cream is something you always to keep in your first aid kit to help you to heal any kind of wound, whether it's, and it can be open and it can be closed. And if you put it on topically to burns, comfrey as well, if you put those things on burns or open wounds, or, you know, cuts and bruises, bug bites, it can help them to heal faster. And then you have boneset and boneset eupatorium perforatum, also another perforated leaf herb. And boneset is another one that can be helpful for knitting bones, and it can be in your formulation for bones. And so it can, again, it can be taken topically, and it can be taken internally as well. And it can be taken homeopathically. A lot of these things that they have all the same indications, as we said. Then there's Ruta graviolens, another one that can be the same thing, can be taken internally, topically, or homeopathically. And Ruta graviolens is really good for tendons and ligaments. So so I like it when somebody sprains their ankle, when they have an ankle sprain or any kind of a sprain strain, and any kind of muscle pain, and especially if it's long-term and ongoing, I like Ruta graviolens. And those, so I have a tendon ligament salve, and that also has comfrey in it, and goldenrod, which is a wonderful anti-inflammatory, and also has this Ruta graviolens in it. And then there's Rust Tux, which is the homeopathic name for poison ivy. And Rust Tux, you can use homeopathically. You never use Rust Tux in material doses, because Rust Tux is poison ivy. And if you use it in a material dose, it's going to give you poison ivy. So that's no good. So anyway, Rust Tux Goedendron, the indications for Rust Tux are arthritis. So if you have ongoing arthritis, and the arthritis is better from warmth, it's worse from sitting still for a long time, better if you start moving around, and then worse if you have continued motion. So Rust Tux can be really helpful that way. Rust Tux is better from heat and worse from cold. So if you have a poison ivy rash, people think, oh, Rust Tux, you know, like cures like. If I use Rust Tux homeopathically on my poison ivy, it's going to feel better. You only use Rust Tux homeopathically for poison ivy if your poison ivy feels better from heat. So if it's worse from cold and better from heat, so in other words, your poison ivy rash feels itchier when you get in bed because you get warm, if it feels itchier, then it's better from cold. You do not use Rust Tux. But if you feel better when you're sweating and hot, and also you want to go in the shower and put hot water on it, and that makes it feel better, then you would use Rust Tux. In fact, anything, any injury that feels better with heat, you consider Rust Tux. So if your poison ivy feels better with cold and worse from heat, it's not a good idea to use Rust Tux. Then you would use something like homeopathic sulfur, which is great for itching, and it's better from cold. Apis is also worse heat and better from cold, and so is belladonna. So you have to use the indications for the remedy, but just get in your head that if you have poison ivy, Rust Tux is not the first thing you should think of. If you forget, check the indications before you use it, and try to remember Rust Tux is only good for poison ivy if the poison ivy is better from heat. If it's better from cold, do not use it. But as a homeopathic remedy, and you only ever use Rust Tux as a homeopathic remedy, obviously. Then there's Bellis perennis, which is English daisy. So English daisy is another Asteraceae. It's another herb in the sunflower family. And daisy is great when the bruising is deep, and it can be also really good after surgery. So it's really deep, intense bruising. So maybe you use arnica and it didn't quite help. Or the bruising sensation just goes on for a long time. That's when Bellis perennis is helpful. And so you often use Bellis perennis after surgery. So that's helpful. Okay.
Yeah. 29.
All right. So there you go. So now I wanted to talk a little bit about sunscreen, because it's that time of year. And so let's talk about chemical sunscreen, the environmental working group's warnings about chemical sunscreens, which can be problematic. So sunscreen products, you're supposed to apply them to the body daily, So you're supposed to apply sunscreen daily, and they can have health effects. The companies are supposed to test them for toxicity and skin absorption and their potential to cause cancer. So there, in 2021, there was an update to regulate these products. They reviewed 16 ingredients and reported that only two ingredients that are used in sunscreen, which are zinc oxide and titanium dioxide, are generally recognized as safe, or GRASE, G-R-A-S-E, based on the availability of it. So do you understand that? So anything else that's not zinc oxide and titanium dioxide is not generally recognized as safe. That means that all the other sunscreens are problematic. So really, if you're using sunscreen, it's better to use sunscreen that doesn't have other ingredients aside from zinc and titanium dioxide. So zinc and titanium dioxide are sunscreens that sit on the top of your skin and they reflect the sun. That's how they work. They just sit on your skin and they reflect. When they're there, they're working for you and you can wash them off and they don't absorb. So that's very nice. So that's why they're not going to be toxic to you. But the other 12 ingredients that are not generally regarded as safe. So I invite you, if you're able to, if you're in your car, don't do this. But if you're at home, go grab your sunscreen and see what the ingredients are. I'm going to read off the ingredients that are not generally recognized as safe. And they are sulisobenzone, patamate O, oxybenzone, octacrolene, octisalate, octinoxate, miradimate, homosalate, ensulazole, dioxybenzone, sinoxate, and avobenzone. I'll read those one more time in case you ran and got your sunscreen and now you want to listen again. Avobenzone, sinoxate, dioxybenzone, ensulazole, homosalate, miradimate, octisalate, octocrylene, oxybenzone, patamate O, and sulisobenzone. So those are really common ingredients in sunscreens, and they could be in your sunscreen, and they could also be in your lip balm. So anything that has sunscreen in it, take a look at that and see if those are in it. They're not generally recognized as safe. They're still allowed to be used in products in the U.S. market until the FDA finalizes the 2021 proposal. The FDA requested additional safety of these ingredients because of health concerns. Studies by the agencies that these show that these ingredients can be absorbed through your skin, and three of them have possible endocrine disrupting effects, and those are homosalate, avobenzone, and oxybenzone. That's homosalate, avobenzone, and oxybenzone. They can have endocrine disrupting properties. In 2021, the European Commission published final opinions on the safety of three non-mineral ultraviolet filters. That's the oxybenzone, homosalate, and octacrolene, and found that two of them, the homosalate and octacrolene, are not safe in the amounts which they're currently used. As a result, the commission proposed limiting the amounts of concentrations as of these filters and sunscreens. The U.S. has different standards, as sunscreen manufacturers are legally allowed to use these chemicals at concentrations higher than the European limits, and that's why hundreds of U.S.-made sunscreens have such high levels of the substances. Oxybenzone, octoxinate, octisalate, octacrolene, homosalate, and avobenzone are all systemically absorbed into the body after use, according to FDA studies. Other studies report sunscreen ingredients have been detected in breast milk, urine, and plasma. Absorption from skin application is not the only way sunscreens end up in the body. It's also possible to inhale them from sprays and probably also from your lip balm. So the constant exposure to sunscreen raises concerns because there's not enough data on the ingredients. So here's a table that outlines human exposure and hazard information for 8 common sunscreens. And oxybenzone does penetrate the skin, does have hormone disruption and skin allergy or other concerns. Octoxinate also penetrates the skin, disrupts hormones, and has skin allergies. Homosalate, same. Octisalate penetrates the skin but doesn't have those hormone disruption or skin allergy issues. Octocrylene penetrates the skin and can cause allergies but isn't hormonally active. Avobenzone, unfortunately, penetrates the skin, disrupts hormones, and can also cause allergies. Titanium dioxide and zinc oxide are safe and have inhalation concerns, but nothing else. So there's specific ingredients it concerns. The most worrisome is oxybenzone. It's readily absorbed through the skin, and there's higher levels of oxybenzone in those who report applying sunscreen, and can also have allergic skin reactions and have hormone disruption issues. So you really have to go look at your sunscreen and see if there's in this. So oxybenzone is probably the one that is best avoided of all of them. Because it does have endocrine, and that's problematic if you already have endometriosis or uterine fibroids or hormone issues. And also you don't want it to go into children because they have developing endocrine systems. The University of California reported a dramatic drop in teen girls' exposure to oxybenzone in cosmetics when they switched from usual products to replacements that didn't have the chemical, suggesting sunscreen products are a significant source of exposure to oxybenzone. Current human exposure levels to oxybenzone were unsafe, and proposed a concentration restriction of 2.2%, lower than the limited amount, which is up to 6% in the U.S. So octoxinate, which is a non-mineral UV filter, is readily absorbed in the skin and continues to be absorbed after the sunscreen has been applied. And animal studies have reported octoxinate has hormone effects on the metabolic system, affects your thyroid. Homosalate is a non-mineral UV filter, which is widely used in U.S. sunscreens. And there's insufficient data. It can penetrate the skin and disrupt hormones. Octosalate, which is a non-mineral UV filter, absorbs through the skin at levels 10 times the FDA cutoff for systemic exposure at 0.5 nanograms per milliliter. The FDA proposed update suggests there's insufficient data to say whether it's safe and effective. Octocrylene absorbs through the skin. Octocrylene absorbs through your skin, and there again, not enough data to say if it's safe. And avobenzone is widely used as a non-mineral filter, and is often used with other non-mineral active ingredients. It's not stable. It has to be paired with other ingredients that act as stabilizers. And it's definitely an endocrine disruptor. So titanium dioxide and zinc oxide are mineral sunscreens. They're made with titanium dioxide. Sunscreens that have those, the only issue there is through inhalation. So it may not be a good idea to have those in sprays. It's better. So really, if you're going to use titanium dioxide or zinc oxide containing sunscreens, it's better to just use it topically. Don't need in creams and lotions as opposed to sprays. There's something called Mixoral SX. It's an uncommon ingredient in the U.S. It was approved by the FDA to use in one specific sunscreen formulation in 2006. It offers strong UVA protection, and there's no research that proves shows evidence of hormone disruption and rare allergies. So that's, again, it's called Mixoral SX. I don't know what product that's in. Then there's aminobenzoic acid, or PABA, and trolamine salicylate are active ingredients that are no longer used in sunscreens. And the risk of these chemicals, that they're actually considered to be unsafe. So that's it. So the big things to look for are oxybenzone and avobenzone. Those things are the most, they're absorbable and hormone disruptive, and they probably are best avoided. So check your sunscreens and see if those are in it. Okay, so that's chemical sunscreens. Okay, so here's some more issues around sunscreens, and here's some advice about protecting yourself from the sun. There's plenty of ways to do it. There's more to it than just putting sunscreen on, so a little prevention goes a long way. Everything a lot of there's doctors that suggest that skin cancer to cosmetics is related to sun damage. Sun damage apparently does the most to increase your risk of skin cancer. Sun protection is a good idea, even if it's not sunny out, even if it's hot and cloudy or cold and sunny, cold and cloudy, or you're driving to an indoor venue. So having sunscreen on every day is a good idea. So sun damage can reduce your skin elasticity. It can reduce collagen. It causes pigmentation, sunspots, and redness, and break blood vessels. Here's myths about sun protection. If you have dark skin, you can't get sunburn. Yes, you can. So even if you're African-American or some other ethnicity where you're very dark, you can still get sunburn. So even if you're dark, you should be using sunscreen. And you can have sun damage and skin cancers no matter what color you are. You do need sunscreen indoors or when you're driving. So there are those who recommend sunscreen every day. It should be in your moisturizer. But again, you really want to avoid that avobenzone and oxybenzone. You need sunscreen even if you're going to be exposed for a few minutes. So put it on daily. Brush your teeth in the morning, put sunscreen on. That's when some people suggest. So it's okay. One application of sunscreen is okay if you're indoors and not by a window. Otherwise, you might want to put it on after you sweat and after you swim. And so again, we have to think about the ingredients of sunscreens, and the best ones. This dermatologist recommends zinc oxide and titanium dioxide because they're going to be the safest ones in the U.S. Sunscreen supposedly doesn't cause vitamin D deficiency. I think it really depends on whether you have a gene that makes it so that it's harder for you to absorb vitamin D. So I test everybody's vitamin D, and I test it at all times during the year. People say I don't take vitamin D in the summer because I'm getting out in the sun. So I check their vitamin D to see where they're at, and if their vitamin D is high enough, then I don't have them take a supplement. Most of the time in Connecticut, people need to, just because we're too far north and we just don't get enough exposure to the sun. It's hard to do. You can get waterproof sunscreen, but you have to keep reapplying it. Nothing is completely waterproof. And so if you go in the water, after you come out of the water, you have to put the sunscreen back on. And it's a good idea to put sunscreen on before you go in the water because you can definitely burn in the water. And it's better to put the sunscreen on at least a half an hour before you get in the pool. Shade is still not enough protection from the sun. You still need the sunscreen or the hat or to cover up. If you don't want to wear sunscreen, you can wear a hat. You can wear clothing that has SPF in it. That's another possibility. And so you can do healthy habits. You can always get healthy habits going to help your skin. And putting on something with SPF, preferably with titanium dioxide or zinc oxide, is a good idea to use most days. So find a broad spectrum one. SPF 30 protects against 97% of the rays, and 50 is 98% of the rays. So you could probably save money by just buying SPF 30 and just applying it a lot. And put it everywhere. People tend to miss their lips, their hands, their feet, their eyelids. So you might want to get a sunscreen. Ears as well. Right, your earlobes and behind your ears, people tend to miss those, and they're all susceptible to sun damage. Lips are a big deal. I like to put, I'm a habitual lip balmer, and I like to use lip balm that has sunscreen in it, and I try to make sure I do that when I'm, most of the time. But if I'm out, definitely if I'm on my bike, I need to put sunscreen with lip balm on because my lips do get chapped and burned if I don't do that. And it might be a good idea to stay outside during peak sun. And that's generally between noon and 3 p.m. And if you're going to be out at that time, use the sunscreen and stay out of the sun if it's possible. You can get sun protective clothes and accessories, wide brimmed hats, sunglasses. Sunglasses have UV protection. Wear darker colors, clothing made of thick materials like denim, if you can stand it. In the heat, that can be an issue. And long sleeves and pants, again, if you can manage to stand that. And you can get sun protective clothing with UPF readings. So the Skin Cancer Foundation says clothing marked UF 50 plus provides excellent protection, and items marked 30 to 49% is very good protection. It's a good idea for everybody, for most people to get skin check once a year, whether it's by your primary care or by a dermatologist. If you have issues, if you had something removed from your skin at some point, then it's better to take up with a dermatologist. But as long as your PCP is checking you every year for your skin, that can be sufficient. People at a higher risk for skin cancer or have skin cancer in the past should speak with their care team and can talk to their PCP, oncologist, or dermatologist. And if you have different kinds of skin, sunscreen can make oily skin feel greasier, and you can get sunscreens that have less grease in them that are, so for people with oily skin, they can have hyaluronic acid in it, which is a moisture grabbing ingredient that our bodies make, and it's in our skin. Green tea and niacinamide, can be anti-inflammatory, and alpha hydroxy acids like lactic or glycolic acid are, they help to take off excess dead skin cells. They're exfoliants. If you have dry skin or your climate is dry, again, hyaluronic acid can be helpful, as can glycerin, dimethicone, and alpha hydroxy acid. If your skin is sensitive, you want to steer clear of these anyway. Parabens and phthalates are endocrine disruptors, and sulfates are just irritating and possibly carcinogenic. And again, mineral-based. If you have dark skin, you may avoid, people with dark skin tend to avoid sunscreen because of the white cast. So you can get sunscreen that matches your skin tone. And you can also get sunscreen that has a tint and have SPF in it. For swimming and water sports, you want to find a broad-spectrum water-resistant sunscreen and keep reapplying. You might want a dry touch or general formulation. There are no waterproof sunscreens, but there are a lot of formulations that give you water resistance. So finding the right sunscreen for you, again, the best ones are going to have titanium dioxide or zinc oxide, and good idea to avoid avobenzone, and if it has benzone at the end, not a good idea. Oxybenzone, avobenzone. So, all right. And so that's some more sunscreen, foods that can help you to get less sunburn. I wouldn't just rely on these. I would also use the mineral-based sunscreens. But astaxanthin is a wonderful antioxidant that's in shrimp. It's what makes flamingos pink, because they eat plankton and things that have the astaxanthin in it. You can take astaxanthin as a supplement. It's a very, very dark red. It's very dark red when you have it in a pill. And it's in krill oil, so you can get it that way as well. But if you want to have concentrated astaxanthin, it can help to protect you against skin cancer. If you take beta-carotene or mixed carotenoids, that will make your fat orange, and it's helpful and protective. If you take fish oil is wonderful and anti-inflammatory. And fish oil can help to reduce inflammation and help to protect you against sunburn. And it just also helps you to rebuild healthy cells in general. That's the sun protection thing. All right, so we're going to start on another topic, and that's exercise basics for peri and postmenopausal women. So this is, we'll start here. We'll see how far we get. We have a little bit of time left, so we'll get started on that. This is an exciting topic. So I'm borrowing from Stacy Sims, who has done a lot of work and research on exercise for perimenopausal women, peri and postmenopausal women, which is I'm a postmenopausal woman. All right. So you have to watch out for messages that talk about us devaluing our power. And that's especially true during menopause, when we're told it's time to slow down and be on the cultural sideline. And so that's changing because there are so many older menopausal women that are famous that are putting menopause in the spotlight and creating an empowering culture. So power is different from strength. Strength is your ability to exert force to overcome resistance, like lifting a barbell off a rack. Power includes speed. It's the force you can generate in a short amount of time. Both are important, but if you want to powering forward as you age, you need to work on your power. So that's power that has strength plus speed. When you compare traditional strength training, which is lifting relatively slowly, with power training, lifting with speed, they found that power training may be superior for improving physical function in healthy older adults. Researchers note that power fades more rapidly than strength as we age. And so you want to be able to react and exert force quickly. So if you are a menopausal woman or postmenopausal woman and you want to improve power, one of the things you can do is look at Stacey Sims' book, Next Level. There are three pillars of training that are essential for power. One is heavy lifting, so you maximize your strength. Plyometrics, which are training your muscles to detonate on demand explosively, and sprint interval training, applying the strength to speed. They're all especially good for menopausal training and belong. Lift heavy, I'm going to use the word stuff. That is not the word she uses. So lift heavy stuff. During menopause, we lose the strength-building stimulus from estrogen, which is essential for regulating satellite cell function in females. It helps us to regenerate muscle stem cells, which are the satellite cells, because they appear to orbit the muscle fiber cells, which help us maintain muscles. When scientists take estrogen from animals in the lab, their ability to regenerate the cells drops up to 60%. That's true in women during menopause. The estrogen levels are linked to the number of satellite cells. When you do resistance training, it's the best way to generate those muscle-making cells, and lifting heavy provides the strength-building stimulus you need as estrogen declines. Heavy lifting is also good for improving fat-burning metabolism and your cardiovascular health. So this is aiming for 3 to 5 sets of 6 or fewer reps with full rest, 2 to 5 minutes between sets. Form is everything. You want to be able to complete each rep with good form. When you can't, you're done. Heavy lifting is best done on big lifts like deadlifts, squats, lunges, and Olympic lifts. So this is really intense lifting. And the thing that concerns me about this is this sounds very good, but the concern is that what if you're injured or you're prone to injury? It seems like lifting heavy, I don't know that I could do this right now because of the condition of my knees and my back and stuff. And then there's plyometrics, which is the same problem. Jumping, hopping, or bounding. Plyometrics is hard when you're older, if you already have knee injuries. And so the thing to do would be to figure out a way to do plyometrics and bursts with less impact. I'm not sure how you can do that with less impact, but if you can do it, it gives those bones and muscles the extra stimulus when you push off against gravity and land back down. So big or small impacts that give those physiological changes, and they help to build bone, which again, we lose during the menopausal transition. Plyometrics trigger epigenetic changes or changes in your genes. You wake up some otherwise quiet genes inside your muscle cells that stimulate the cells to improve power and the composition of the muscle, so that improves the integrity of the muscle. They help mitochondria to function better, and they help your insulin sensitivity. You can start with a squat jump. Again, I can't jump right now. Stand with your feet wider than shoulder width, feet turned out a little bit, extend your arms straight in front of you, squat down, extending your arms behind you until your butt drops below knee level, quickly extend your legs and jump in the air, land softly, immediately dropping into another squat, do it 8 to 10 times, start with one set, work up to 2. Again, How do you do that if you have
there's
knee issues?
There's I just looked up plyometric exercises, low impact, and plyometric workout that requires no jumping.
Right.
There's lots of stuff on the internet.
So that would be something to look at. So you can apparently you can do plyometrics without jumping with if you have issues with injuries and stuff. Right. So if you want to maintain your top end, you need to train. You need to train your top end. That means sprinting. So the best type of high-intensity interval training for women is sprinting. Okay. So that's especially true during the menopausal transition. And so you want to do super short, sharp sprint-style intervals lasting about 30 seconds or less. When you extend the intervals past 60 seconds, you get greater increases in cortisol. So really short, so 30 seconds, that's it. So that means when you're pushing till you push as hard as you can, but just for 30 seconds, then rest until you feel recovered, and then do it again. And maybe, so especially menopause, you don't want to encourage cortisol. And with sprint intervals, you get the benefits, improved insulin sensitivity, stronger mitochondria, improved fat burning, especially deep visceral fat, and ever important boost of growth hormone. Tabatas, that's how you add intensity to any exercise. Push as hard as possible for 20 seconds, recover for 10, repeat 6 to 8 times. And then you rest for 5 minutes and repeat 2 or 3 more times. So, yeah. All right. So I think that's going to be where we're going to leave it for this week. And then I actually have an article for next week about power building exercises without jumping.
Yeah.
And we're going to go into a few more of these. All right. So so I'm going to leave it there.
Everything is possible.
Everything is possible. Yeah, it's true. You have been listening to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician, with my co-host Ron Meniza. You can email me with questions and comments at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show in another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, and Spotify. You may also watch the recorded Facebook Live and Instagram Live episode at Fran Storch, ND. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. The information presented on this show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. Thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath, your show where you can learn about the best of science and nature. We'll be back with more Radio Naturopath next week at 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores, and WHUS.org.